certain ambiguities. He wants to operate in the word, which is pretty much straight word, not the quantized word, when you have a certain loop that you're trying to meet. So that would be what I was trying to say. Andrew Gia.
Glenn Waits has got a better way of explaining it. KC2QIQ, K2LAW, how do you see it, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, first take a minute, making it over the noise.
And you're doing beautifully. Go right ahead.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, the way I see it, Dick, is like this. It's like the same reason why we stack Yagis. If you had one of the stack antennas, every time you add another antenna, so if you went from one Yagi to two Yagis, you're increasing the gain by 3 dB, or doubling the power output that the receiver would see. So by adding two antennas, basically, you're doubling the signal. If you double the power, you're doubling the signal. In this particular case, you have doubled the power and doubled the antennas. So really what's happening is that's why you're seeing four. It's, you know, you have two times two, two times the antennas and two times the power. So it's really not that complex. If you think about just doubling up your antennas, you're always going to have 3 dB more gain by adding the second antenna. Let me let it drop. And by doubling the power, you're going to double the power. So there's really, whether the two antennas are stacked or whether the antennas are in slightly different directions, it's two antennas. And then, of course, you're adding a second transmitter, so it's double the power. So it's really adds up to four very easily, I think. I hope that's a better explanation. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Glenn. And by the way, whenever you're stacking antennas, whether it be Yagi, dipoles, or whatever, there is a definite minimum distance you've got to get between those antennas so that the near field of the antennas are not interfering with each other. In the case of the dipoles, a little bit less than the length of the dipole as a spacing is more than enough. In the case of Yagis, you've got to calculate what is the circular effective capture area of those individual Yagis, and you vertically stack them so that those two circles of capture area just barely kiss each other or very slightly overlap just at the edge. Once you've doubled the number of antennas, and lots of guys will stack Yagis like Glenn is talking about, you do every time you double the number of Yagis you're stacking, and whether you horizontally stack them, vertically stack them, or both, that's your choice, every time you double the number of Yagis, you will come up 3 decibels more in gain. So you go from 1 Yagi to 2 Yagis, 3 dB more gain. 2 Yagis to 4 Yagis, 3 dB more gain. 4 Yagis to 8 Yagis, 3 dB more gain, and so on. So those pictures you can see of my 16 Yagi array antenna that had a bunch of relays in the phasing harness. Let me drop. You can see that in the March, I think it's 1985. I got to go look at that issue. CQ Ham Radio Magazine, March issue, and was it 2010, 2012? I can't even find out what year it was. You'll see these beautiful computer-generated plots of Yagi patterns of this 16 Yagi array where I could feed all 16 Yagis at once, one vertical column of 4 Yagis, or one single Yagi. Each time I went from 1 to 4 to 16, there was a 6 decibel change in each one of those two steps. And so it was a zoom control. So the bottom line is doubling the number of antennas with proper stacking distance and proper phasing doubles the antenna gain. And when you turn on a second transmitter, because you're doing two antennas with two separate transmitters as opposed to one transmitter with a power divider, you're transmitting twice as much power, twice as much gain, you come up 4 dB. Although it seems crazy, you literally can. If each antenna is acting independently, in other words, if each antenna is far enough stacked from each other that the capture areas are not overlapping, just like happens when you've got a direct path to an antenna and you've got a ground reflected path, and you've also got a reflection off the building and a reflection off the water tower and so on, you add up the signal strength, of each one of those paths by adding up the voltage. It's a crazy phenomenon. When multiple signals from multiple directions arrive at one single receiving antenna, common sense would lead you to believe you're adding individual chunks of power. Good common sense, dead wrong. Mother Nature doesn't behave that way. She adds the individual voltages in a vector manner. She's adding them considering the phases, their phase angles. Mother Nature thinks in voltage in almost every example you can think of. Opposite of common sense. But if you make that leap of faith that Mother Nature thinks in voltage and she adds the individual voltages coming to the antenna from individual directions, all of a sudden you get the right answer. I'll admit it's not easy to swallow at first. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I know it already 30 years what you're saying, but I understand that a different way. When you increase the antenna pattern and you add up the leaf in the particular direction, you're actually increasing the aperture of this antenna. So the doubling the power never happened. You never have double power. You double the voltage, yes, I can agree. You double the voltage or you double the power artificially. But the physical increasing of power never happened. Do you agree with that?
Now, there's sort of a yes and a no to that. I'm going to give you an example. Assume now I've got a great big antenna range, which is a flat piece of ground equal to a mirror. And therefore, I've got no other objects on this antenna range. So therefore, there is a direct signal going to the receiving antenna. There's a ground-bound signal going to the receiving antenna. If I would stretch absorbing material on the ground, so there is no ground-bound antenna. I can do it by absorbing material, fences with absorbing material on the top of the fence, and so on. I can stop the ground-bound. Okay. If I did that, the signal strength at the receiving antenna would change by 6 dB. Here I've got one single transmitter, one main path from the transmitting antenna to the receiving antenna, and I take a reference reading. Then I remove the anechoic material off the ground so that now I'm getting the ground bounce, and the signal at the receiving antenna goes up by 6 dB. I didn't change the amount of transmit power. I doubled the voltage going to the receiving antenna, and the receiving antenna went up by 6 dB. Let me show you why. Look at it from the other point of view. Let me drop. Make believe your eye is located at the receiving antenna. Your eye can look directly at the transmitter, and you see a signal coming toward you. Beautiful. You look down a little bit at the reflection off the ground, you see a second signal from the ground bounce angle. Whether or not that signal came from that direction because somebody below the ground turned on a second transmitter and the ground became transparent, and now you're getting a second signal from a second transmitter, you can't tell the difference. Is there a second transmitter below the ground giving you that ground bounce signal? Or the signal from the transmitting antenna that hit the ground before, when there was anechoic material there, that signal got absorbed. You remove the absorbing material off the ground, now it's as if you turned on a second transmitter. A second angle of reception has occurred. You don't know whether it's due to a second transmitter or a reflection from the first transmitter, which wouldn't be a reflection if the ground wasn't there. So when you get ground bounce, you can get as much as 6.02 dB of increase in the signal getting to the receiving antenna. Once again, although it doesn't sound right, you figure out the voltage of each one of the signal paths, add up all of those voltages, and you get the right answer. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I understand it this way, guys. You never have increased of the power. Never happened, never gonna happen, never happened in the history. What is happening is, you have something that you could send all of the power from the transmitter to the receiver, you would have X amount of dBs as the receiver antenna. Now, you say, I know that I'm sending to the receiver only 3% of my power, and 97% of this power is waste. It's just going around. If you count all of those nodes all around links, then you will be able to see, okay, that with the 100 watt of power, whatever it is. Now, the additional reflection, whatever is there, is just a way to recover the part of the energy from the transmitter that is otherwise to be lost. Do you agree with that?
KC2QIQ with a comment, Dick, on this one?
I agree with that. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, Wesley, I think what's happening here, too, is you have to think of ERP, effective radiated power. I'm sure Dick could probably explain this a lot better than me, but realistically, what ERP is that when you look at the gain of your antenna, that there was an omnidirectional antenna, it's going to put out signals in all directions. If you have antennas with gain, it's going to start focusing that power in a more focused direction. So as you go around the antenna, you'll see that the power is higher in certain locations and lower in others. So an antenna with its gain has to be added to the transmitter power to give you the ERP, or the affected radiated power. So you can see increases in power in some areas of the antenna and lower in the other areas. So ERP will always affect the amount of received signal at the receiver for on the other end. Dick, maybe you've got a better explanation for it than I have in my simple one. Q2RW, KC2QIQ.
You're absolutely right, Glenn, but now I'm going to take Wes's original discussion of 98% of the power going in some random direction. One of the things we frequently forget about is real signal amplitudes. In theory, I can make a perfect piece of waveguide between my transmitting site and my receiving site. And if I'm transmitting a watt of power, I can make sure that close to a watt of power gets to the receiver by way of a quality piece of waveguide. I could use that as a reference. Okay. Now, when you plug in the formula, free space loss equals 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. F is frequency in megahertz, D is distance in miles. You plug in real numbers on a real antenna range at real VHF, UHF frequencies. You'll be amazed. You might set up your antenna range to be 100 feet long. And you assume you've got an isotropic transmitting antenna and an isotropic receiving antenna. And they're aimed directly at each other, so to speak. You go through that calculation, you'll find out there's 46 dB of loss at some particular frequency. In other words, the power gotten to the receiving antenna across a 100-foot range is 1/40,000th the power you transmitted. That isn't 99% or 98% power wasted. It's 99.999% wasted. Real signal strengths, real radio distances, are amazingly big ratios. The real received power you get is so infinitesimal compared to what you transmitted. That's the reason why the average receiver has 120 decibels of gain between the antenna connector and the output to the loudspeaker. 120 dB of gain is a typical mediocre receiver because the signals you get are in many cases microvolts of received signal when you've transmitted hundreds of volts, in some cases, transmit signal. Real paths, free space, perfect path has got some huge losses so that when any path other than the main path is reflecting a signal to you, you're ordinarily getting such a small signal. To double that small signal, at first it sounds like you're getting something for nothing. But what you're getting is so extremely small to begin with. Doubling it means it's still extremely small, just twice as big at being extremely small. That's another one of the factors. that makes it a little bit easy to explain why you've doubled the number of antennas, you've doubled the antenna gain, you've doubled the ERP, and before you add a second transmitter, that alone will make the signal 3 dB louder. You add a second transmitter, so you're doubling your number of watts, you'll get a 4 to 1 increase. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I understand that. Then it's pretty much straightforward. The only thing is that the guy is extremely smart, and I assume he's a ham radio operator, although he hired it himself. When you go through his mathematics, and that's the link that you have in your email below the video link, you're going to be surprised how many things will pop to your mind in question. The same as I suggest to do for Glenn. Because when you go and you follow the math, exactly what we were discussing looks a little bit different. Definitely, the Faraday law, when experimented, doesn't really match with many realities, and that Professor Levin was also saying that the central laws of physics doesn't work. And most of the problems that we have is we have when we go into the quantum physics. Because it just tends to omit certain ambiguity. I don't even know how to say it. But when you go further with what he's saying, he's perfectly explained the luminiferous of the ether and the presence of the ether and the understanding of how the ether looks like in his terms, and it looks pretty much straightforward. Although the ether was rejected by the main science, now the Fermi lab scientists, they say, hey, you know, the space is not empty. It's a soup that is there. And so it's here.
Okay. The antenna paradox, I think we've almost gone through that one. And I believe you're now going into some of the other mathematics of one of those emails you mailed us. And that's the mathematics which starts explaining or trying to understand the ether, the mysterious soup substance that's between the transmit antenna and the receiving antenna. And I do know that Michelson, Morley, and a bunch of other people did a series of experiments trying to measure the presence of the so-called ether and the Faraday and the Doppler shift they expected to get when the Earth is going in one direction versus the other direction around the sun, so to speak. And so, as I see it, all experiments to look for the ether have not found it. I mean, the presence of the ether, the presence of a medium that you think is required. Has to flow through. Every attempt to measure So, Ted? The question becomes, does that ether really exist? And there's a lot of evidence to say, no, it doesn't exist. Let me do a little experiment here. Okay. See if I can make my signal a little bit stronger. Which is what I'm trying to do. Like I said, that's the best I can do tonight. So, I think you're telling me, West, his mathematics was trying to prove something about the ether. And I wasn't able to follow it. I didn't have the time to...
Please get 2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Versus engineers who work in applied sciences, where we're actually applying physical mathematics to experiments, where, as engineers, we're always trying to make our mathematics and our experiments match, and then we make products from that. So if we have an experiment on the bench that works and we don't have mathematics to back it up, we get a little spooked as engineers. Or vice versa, if we have mathematics and we can't get it to work on the bench, we get a little spooked as engineers. We want to see both work. And in a lot of the science papers, where they're just basically trying to explain results, many times they end in question marks. But here, from the engineer's point of view, we want to see the match on both ends. We want to see the physical mathematics and the lab experiment match on both ends. So sometimes you do see that difference in philosophy between the pure sciences and the engineering end of the business, I guess, so to speak. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Well, Fermilab postulates that ether exists, but also it has a certain terms and conditions for the existence of that the ether. Anyhow, the new trend is to act as if the space is not empty at all, but it's saturated and to exist.
Have you ever seen any
or quantum fluctuation, or particles, or under particles,
that can appear or disappear after a short period of time. Now you're asking to yourself, what is the mechanism of it? This is how the Fermi Lab came to the conclusion. Actually, they are the major scientific force trying to implement a idea of ether as something that would then be used for the analysis of the certain phenomena. And so it's here.
Glenn, you want to take that? KCQQIQ, KQRIW. I may have to wait until this guy moves away from the eastern repeater. He's nice and close to the eastern repeater, giving them a lot of grief tonight. He's mobile. He's having a grand old time. But once again, Wes, do you know of any written theory, experiment, or whatever that has confirmed the presence of ether? The idea of ether has been around for a couple of hundred years. I know of no experiment to confirm its existence. It's a great sounding theoretical substance, but I don't think anybody's ever confirmed it. N2XJN, KQLIW.
Well, the traditional physics says that through any or even microscopic interaction that could be described by quantum theories, certain consistent theory of quantum gravity has not been formulated. And the clinical information about the aspect of gravitational force microscopic level and the dependency of the forces, gravitational forces, of any existence of the medium that would then be called ether doesn't exist. But the gravitational attraction of two protons and two quarks, it's much weaker than the electric force between protons and the cell force. And these are being called the color force between quarks. And that made the scientists from Fermi Lab thinking, if we have a kind of difference, we've got to have something that influences or something that makes this difference happen. Thank you.
that the nuclear phenomenon, strong force, protons, neutrons, quarks, hadrons, leptons, do you believe any of that is at least locally explaining a ether inside the atom itself? Because outside of the atoms, I see a lot of evidence that no one has been able to measure ether. Do you believe that the sub...
Of course I do. There are so many things that I am explaining. When we deal with ether, then we deal with something that has a charge, which then would be the problem. And then we have the electron. When you look at the mass of the proton, that is a billion times mass than hydrogen, is 1,600 times equal to the mass of the electron. But from the proton is something that is not unbeatable. It's here in sense where the particles are matter, whether it is a copper, a gold, a calcium, carbon, whatsoever. But guess what? You have a tiny electron, and the tiny electron, when you have one electron and one proton, they cancel each other. They create a balance. So the atomic structure then is in balance. But then you take the mass difference in it. Now, when you look at that, you have another problem. This problem is neutron. The neutron by itself, it has a just a little bigger mass as an electron, as the proton, which would be mass of the proton plus mass of one electron. But because it's something that is absolutely not involving something that doesn't have a charge. You say, okay, in there, they get what? The electron could travel between an atom because it doesn't have a charge. It's not being repelled. It doesn't really obey the laws of
Let me do a little experiment here. Okay, looks like the best I'm going to get. Wasn't able to hear all that you said, Wes, but most of it. Are you sure that when a nuclear-emitting natural material that's giving off gamma rays, are you sure that after those gamma rays are given off for some number of years, isn't there some measurable amount of change in the mass of that material that's giving off gamma rays? That energy has to be coming from somewhere. Now, maybe the change in mass is so small that it's very hard to measure. But a nuclear material naturally giving off gamma rays, although the number of protons in general is not changing, if it started off as uranium, it ends up as uranium. It's not changing which element of the periodic table, which is the number of protons. But still, isn't it possible that the number of neutrons is changing, or some other method of changing mass takes place by which gamma radiation is given off? Into XJM, K2RIW.
From what is the origin of the gamma rays? Because surprisingly, we try to simplify a certain process to find that everything that is outside of the nuclear is that or is exit. And let's say you have something that is happening in the nuclear would be an electron capture. So one of the electrons from the same side would be the closest one to be observed by the nuclear.
Thank you. Echo Oscar. Kilo Zulu. It's N2. KZ listening.
Morning call.
N2KZ. A real ham. N2EO.
Yeah, good morning. Okay. Very good. N2EO from N2KZ, good morning. Hope you're feeling okay this morning. Nice to hear you're on. Okay, I know this is a continuation of yesterday morning's conversation, but real ham as opposed to what? The poster board ham or ham impersonator? I give up. Over to you. Okay, cool. There's a jammer in there. Don't worry about it. Well, I think my woman like myself. You took the test at the FCC. I don't believe that the BEC program is on it. I don't believe there are people in it who are on it. But I've seen too many people out there getting licenses that they really don't deserve. And also, I think it was a total mistake to eliminate the code. Okay, call in to the okay, speaking from my humble group up here in Westchester and Putnam County, I can tell you that we're downright nutty about being to the book. We have stopped people that we think might have been cheating one way or another. Not that that happens very often. It doesn't. But
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Are far, far apart. Since there's usually about 8 CEs to 3 or 4 people being tested, they're watched a lot. I guess there are inconsistencies, so to speak. But I can't see any on my watch. Back to you.
Okay, Carl, you gotta watch it there. You don't get the beat of going on. We got the nutcase in there, Jim, and it'll be it. And so we out. Well, I know, for instance, three people who are now passed away went to Yonkers. And they got, I don't know where in Yonkers, but they went, these were guys who were technicians for life. And they all got X's. And I know how it was done. Because they said so. In Yonkers.
Okay, well, as far as I know, there's only two groups in Yonkers. And it has been that way for the longest time. There's the YRC, the Yonkers Radio Club. And those guys have been meeting in the police station off the Sawmill River Parkway on a regular basis for, I'd say, at least 20 years. I think that they moved to that location in about 2000, maybe 1999, somewhere in there. And then there's also the W5YI group, which is really like two people at this point. And they give exams. They're most noted for giving the commercial exam. One of the last places you can take the commercial exam. And they're... But honestly, they're
for all intents and purposes, pretty much the same people who chair the Yonkers Radio Club group. So, I don't know. But, I have an extra. I only took 5 words of code. I never got a chance to do 13 or 20. But since that's all I do, I think I've passed. N2EO from N2KZ.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay. Okay, Carl, you climbed up and you just made it. N2KZ, N2EO. All right, well, I took it at the FCC, 20 words a minute. Yeah, we're going to tell you. I think it was mistaken. I think when the FCC said test yourselves, I think the ARRL should have taken the FCC.